His name was Sheikh Ahmad ibn Abdallah, and I saw him every morning for the next month. I would sit at his feet while he read to me from the works of the medieval Arab sages and elucidated them for me. His erudition was vast, his insight the result not of knowledge, but of direct experience. I put the incident of Katrina's voice down to the strain of travel. When I mentioned it to Duncan, he merely said that in the Sheikh's house a man might see or hear whatever was in his heart. Well, at the time it seemed a reasonable explanation, and one that suited me to believe. For to have thought it anything but a self-generated hallucination might well have sent me over the edge of madness. Duncan told me a little of the Sheikh, explaining that he had been responsible for introducing his grandfather to the inner world of Arab occultism. "I can scarcely believe it possible," I said. "Unless your grandfather was very old at the time and the Sheikh very young." "This was in 1898, said Duncan, "when my grandfather was 52, about the same age I am now. In the account he left of their meeting, he wrote that the Sheikh was already an old man then." "And you're sure it's the same man?" Duncan looked hard at me. "I have been coming here for most of my adult life. There is very little I would not believe." One day, when we had been about 3 weeks in Fez, I entered a stationer's shop in order to buy a fresh notebook and a few pens. As I was paying for my goods, I noticed that there was a telephone on the wall at the back, and I guiltily remembered my plan to ring Harriet and ask about Ian. I felt a wave of homesickness when the familiar British ringing tone began. It rang for over a minute before anyone answered. Then an unfamiliar voice came on the line, a woman's voice, plain and non-committal. "Gillespie?" "Is Harriet there?" I asked. "No, Harriet's away. Who is this?" "I'm a friend. I'm ringing to see how Ian is. I had a letter from Harriet saying he was ill." There was a pause. I could hear the line crackling, as though we were about to be cut off. "Ian is dead," the woman answered. I could sense an emotion in her voice quickly suppressed. "He died in hospital 4 weeks ago. I'm very sorry if..." I put the phone down. My hand was shaking. The stationer asked if I was all right. I nodded briskly and made my escape, leaving my notebook and pens behind. The next morning, like every other, I met with the ancient Sheikh in his room. His bright eyes turned to me. "You said when you first came that you do not seek longevity, but mastery. What if I were to say to you that this woman whom you loved might be brought back to life again?" He did not take his eyes off me as he said it. "That would be very cruel," I said. "Katrina is dead. Her body is in a grave, rotting." "Nevertheless," his voice was hard, unyielding, "if it were said, what would you give? I ask you merely to suppose." "To have her back?" I thought it safest to play his game. "Everything," I said. "I would give everything. Your own life? Your soul?" "Yes," I said, "if it would bring her back." He smiled for the first time. "You have started to learn," he said. We left Fez the following day. Of what followed, I retain but the haziest memory. Our destination was Marrakesh, where we took a small house of our own in the Medina, and where Duncan was visited daily by a succession of holy men and seers. One day, towards the end of September, Duncan told me it was time to return home. On the last evening, we came back to the house after an early meal. We both had some packing to do, I had about a dozen books that had been given to me in the course of the journey, and I found that the last five would not fit into my suitcase. Taking them with me, I went to Duncan's room. He was standing by an open window, looking out into the street. "There's still some room in my case," he said, without turning round. "You'll find it in the bedroom." Duncan's case was lying open on the bed. He had left a few shirts ready to place on top. I lifted out some items in order to make space for the books. They fitted with room to spare. As I made to straighten the clothes, something drew my attention. I do not know why. Perhaps I had unconsciously been looking for it. A length of striped cloth, quite unmistakable. A new college scarf. Ian's scarf. The one he'd been wearing when he visited my flat that afternoon all those months ago. When Duncan turned up on the doorstep, Ian had left in a rush. He called about it the next day, but I couldn't find the scarf anywhere in the flat. I remembered a conversation I had once had with Duncan about good and evil, and his remark concerning the method by which one might cause a man to fall ill or die. "The most that is needed is a lock of the victim's hair or an article of his clothing to be his representative." We got back to Edinburgh as the year turned. The summer had unsettled and confused me, and my discovery of Ian's scarf had awakened the darkest suspicions, but I felt powerless to pursue them, even in the safety of my own mind. My job at the university had been irrevocably terminated, so I signed on for unemployment benefit. I would be worse off, but I reasoned that I would gain by having the freedom to channel my research in the directions I wanted. Duncan immediately offered to pay the rent on my flat. I said I could not possibly accept. "You've already paid a small fortune to take me to Morocco and keep me there," I said. "Hardly a fortune, Andrew. Frankly, I've invested a great deal in you and your arcane education. I'm not prepared to let you just go like that." He paused. "You can repay me later." Early in November, Duncan took me to his home in the country for the first time. Penshiel House was a sombre dwelling in the Scottish baronial style, situated to the east of the city at the foot of the Lammermuir Hills. It was a cold, bleak day, with a sky that threatened sleet or even snow. As we drew near the house, rolling down a long, twisting drive in Duncan's Jaguar, it seemed to me that the air grew darker still. We ate in a low-ceilinged dining room at a table built to seat at least 20. After dinner, we sat in his study, drinking coffee. "This is a large house to live in alone," I said. A huge fire burned in the open grate, painting the walls a deep copper colour. Duncan stared at the flames. "I was married once," he said, "just like you. And like yours, my wife died. Her name was Constance. She lived here with me. We were very happy, happier than I would have thought was possible." To my dismay, I saw that his cheeks were wet with tears. It was the first weakness I had seen in him, the first sign of emotion. The knowledge of it made me feel strangely ill at ease, as though it awakened an echoing weakness in myself. "I'm growing morbid," he said. "I'm sorry." By now it had grown dark outside. The storm had already turned to a blizzard, and was now firmly fastened to the countryside. "I'll try to drive you back if you really want me to," said Duncan. "But I think you'll be better off staying the night." I had little choice. The housekeeper was roused to make a bed up for me. A fire was lit and hot water bottles made ready to air and warm the bed. I thanked Duncan for his kindness and retired with a copy of Scott's Bride of Lammermuir, whose action is set not far from Penshiel House. Already drowsy, I did not read for long. I switched off the light and was soon heavily asleep. It must have been about 3 o'clock when I woke. The wind had fallen, leaving a tangible silence in its wake. Though the fire had died down almost to nothing, the room was still warm and stuffy. I crossed to the window and drew aside the curtain. Outside, the sky had cleared, leaving a swathe of brilliant stars and a sharply etched moon. The ground was iced with snow. I had never seen such stillness, or whiteness so intensified. Unclipping the catch, I pushed the window open. It slid up on the sash without a sound, and I leaned forward, breathing in the ice-cold air. I sat there for a long time, invigorated and entranced. But as I reached up to draw the window down again, something caught my eye. I held my breath, thinking that I had surprised a fox or a squirrel moving across the snow. But it was larger. Big enough to be a wolf, I thought. Except that there are no wild wolves in Scotland now. As I watched, the creature moved again, crawling in the direction of the house. It had long legs and moved awkwardly, more like a spider or a crab than an animal of the forest accustomed to walking on all fours. As I watched it come towards me, I felt more than simple cold rush through me. There was something unnatural about the thing on the ground. I could not tear myself from the window, horrified and frightened though I was. The creature moved slowly, yet with determination, across the still surface of the open field, dragging its limbs through the snow, leaving in its wake a narrow furrow. From time to time it would halt and lift its head, as though sniffing the air. Was it hunting? Was it blind and merely questing? As it reached a point about halfway, I could see it more clearly, though mercifully, not in any detail. It stopped again and raised its front quarters, then raised its head, and I was sure that long matted hair, like a woman's, trailed from it, and that it was, in some sense, human. Suddenly, another form appeared, this time from the direction of the house. A man wearing a long coat was walking towards the creature, and in moments I recognized him as Duncan. I almost cried out to warn him of the creature's presence, but it was quickly apparent that he was heading straight for it. Trudging through the deep snow, he took perhaps half a minute to reach it. When he did so, he bent down and helped it raise itself on its legs. His back concealed it from me at first, then as he moved to one side in order to assist it, I saw it stand erect. And though it was still too far for me to see more than the outline, I saw that it wore a long dress and that its hair fell almost to the ground. I did not sleep again that night. In the morning, I went again to my bedroom window. The sky was thick, and more snow had fallen. Whatever tracks had been left on the meadow had been obliterated.